It's a snowy lead up to Thanksgiving here at 8,000 feet. Welcome to Go West Young podcast from the Center for Western Priorities. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on the show this week, we will head south for a conversation about the environmental impact of President Trump's proposed border wall. From jaguars to pronghorn, even increased flood risk, this was an eye-opening conversation for me. And this week in Western history, a union uprising in a Colorado mining town, but who actually planted the bomb? First, though, let's talk about the news. It's been a rough couple weeks on the job for Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, and not just because President Trump very publicly overruled Zinke's decision to allow imports of dead trophy elephants from Africa. No, it is the travel stuff, once again in the news. First, Zinke got smacked around by the Interior Department's Inspector General for keeping, quote, deficient travel records. That includes not distinguishing between personal, political, and official travel, also not documenting how Secretary Zinke's wife Lola's travel was paid for when she tagged along. And after that, documents released in response to a public records request from the Western Values Project showed just how involved Lola was in the early days at Interior. They show Interior staff time being used to coordinate her travel, including a last-minute scramble to have her join a dinner with Alaska's governor. Despite that letter from the Inspector General and those emails, the Interior Department still insists that everything is above board here. That claim is getting harder to believe by the day, but hey, at least they didn't fall back on the old whatever Lola wants, Lola gets defense. This week, we're talking about President Trump's dream of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall.
Now, we are not going to talk about immigration policy today. Yes, it's important. I don't want anyone to assume that because we are not talking about immigration policy, that anyone on this panel is at all on board with what the president is or is not supporting. It's just not in our wheelhouse for this particular podcast. But what we are going to dive into is what that wall could do to ecosystems along the U.S.-Mexico border. So joining us, Katie Davis, Western Director with the Wildlands Network. She is on the line from Salt Lake City.
Hello there.
We've got Brian Bird, the Southwest Program Director with Defenders of Wildlife, joining us from Santa Fe.
Thank you for having me.
And Kieran Kennedy with the Sierra Club's Lands and Wildlife Program. She is in Washington, D.C. today.
Hey, y'all.
Katie, I want to start with you because Wildlands Network just this month put out a report focusing on four species that could be pushed into extinction by the border wall. Very briefly, what species are we talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So yes, we put out a report. It was entitled Four Species on the Brink. And we looked at native wide-ranging species, charismatic species in the borderlands region. And those four species were the Mexican wolf, black bear, jaguar, and Sonoran pronghorn.
The pronghorn in particular caught my eye. I grew up in Tucson. My grandfather lived in a little town called Sonoyta, which is basically exactly where that herd is now near Sonoyta and Elgin. And I didn't even realize that there were pronghorn in Arizona. This is a very small and very fragile population that we're talking about here.
Yes, it is. And it's not surprising that you were unfamiliar with Sonoran pronghorn. Actually, many people are. That was actually part of why we put out this report. I think most people in the U.S. have really no idea the type of biological diversity and wildlife that exists in the borderlands. The perception is a sort of bleak desert region. But actually, there's thriving wildlife, great diversity, one of the top wildlife diversity locations in the world, actually. And so we wanted to spotlight these species and communicate that information, get more people aware of these species, their plight, and the effect that the wall would have on them.
And so the pronghorn then in particular, you've got a small population on the Arizona side, a slightly larger population on the Mexico side. So how much do these populations rely on interbreeding?
Yes, that's a great question. The populations are quite small. We tried to take the best available data for this report, and actually tracking of pronghorn populations is difficult and inconsistent. But we found, as far as we could tell, there's a little under 1,000 individuals in Mexico and a little over 300 in the United States. Those population numbers have been all over the place. In 2002, there was a significant drought in the region. that decreased the number of species or individuals of pronghorn in the U.S. by 83%. So significant ups and downs, significantly dependent on weather and climate and other factors like other human development. There's lots of highways, canals, other infrastructure that these pronghorn are dealing with. And that's been a huge factor in the decline of the Sonoran pronghorn as we've seen this infrastructure development. And, you know, up until fairly recently, we knew that there were individuals that were crossing the border. We actually spotlighted in our report one male in 2008 that was born in the U.S. and was tracked via a radio collar to a herd in Mexico that had joined up. So we know that these individuals were crossing the border, likely interbreeding. More recently, we have less documentation of that, but the infrastructure that's currently there for the border wall, which is for most of the area that we're looking at, is vehicle barrier, which is more friendly to wildlife than the pedestrian fencing and other types of wall that we see, allowed these individuals for the moment, as far as we can tell, to continue to cross over. And that interbreeding is really important for a number of reasons. This is a very small population. As I noted, they've had significant declines previously based on events that are outside of our control to some extent. And so we need to keep these populations interbreeding, intermixing, hopefully so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we've lost so much genetic diversity that we could see a localized extinction, for instance, in the U.S., or decline in genetic diversity that would result in decreased reproductive ability or other things that come about with inbreeding, like higher risk of disease. So those types of things are things that conservationists on both sides of the border have been working to try to prevent for many years. There's mitigation activities happening for many of these highways and other infrastructure developments, and a wall, if you know, put into practice as conceived by the president, a sort of large physical structure would essentially completely prevent any of that interbreeding, any movement of that population. And you would, I think, certainly see declines on both sides of the border, most likely in the U.S. And that's a long-term threat to species that is listed under the Endangered Species Act and that we are all trying to work toward recovery for, and that would see recovery on both sides of the border.
So I want to take a step back. Brian, Defenders of Wildlife is also working on a report, but you're looking a bit more at the history of cross-border conservation work. Walk us through some of that and what's at stake here. If a wall gets built, what happens to that the binational work that has gone into what to species conservation?
Right. Well, there is a rich and long history of binational conservation along the entire 2,000-mile long U.S.-Mexico border. Oftentimes, people think about the border and they think about deserts and they think about, you know, they hear about how dangerous it is. And those are false impressions. Those are stories that we've started to tell ourselves about the border. The real story is that this is incredibly rich region culturally. It's rich in biological diversity and it's rich in history of conservation from end to end. For example, the most well-known, of course, is the Big Bend National Park in Texas, but that's just the U.S. side. If you look at the Mexico side, there are vast areas of protected landscapes, including the Maderas del Carmen and the Parque Nacional Cañon Santa Elena, and you have these large, what I call conservation complexes, from Texas, the lower Rio Grande Valley, all the way out to San Diego in California. You have these huge complexes of protected landscapes where, as Katie was describing, wildlife move freely back and forth and exchange genetic material and look for resources like water and food. And this history goes way back, and there's a lot of investment that is at risk. If we build this border wall across the entire length of the border, a lot of this investment, both financial investment, but also investment of blood and sweat and tears of people that care about this region and care about its conservation, is at risk. And I'll just say one more thing, and that's that these conservation landscapes contributes significantly to both local and regional economies. For example, the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge in Texas pumps $35 million per year into the local economy, mostly from bird watching. And so, you know, those types of economies are at risk. Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge would be cut off from the United States if Trump builds his border wall. And we just, you know, that's just not the way we want to see this incredible legacy treated.
I want to bring in Kieran Kennedy from Sierra Club, because the club has worked on borderlands issues for years, decades now. And one of the things that the Sierra Club highlights is the legal impacts and the number of laws that end up getting ignored when walls get built along the border. How much of that is a concern? And Kieran, what do you think would happen if a wall starts getting built in terms of a legal fight?
Oh, man. Well, there's already over 600 miles of wall already on the border, and that started in the first part of this fight in the mid-2000s. And when that fight happened, over 30 environmental laws were waived just in building aspects of the wall in California and aspects of the wall in Arizona. And Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, and a few other organizations actually went in to try and litigate on these waivers, and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, the court chose not to take up our case. And the reasoning around some of that and what has made that difficult is that they actually put it in law under the Secure Fence Act, and also again in the Real ID Act, that the Secretary of Homeland Security had the right to waive some key laws to expedite the building of the wall. And we've seen major, major damages from that. In Oregon, Pike Cactus National Monument, a large aspect of the border wall was washed away in 2011. There are proposals right now to build levee walls along the Santa Ana Wildlife Refuge. And the problem is that when you start building walls and already cutting off migration corridors and then damming them as well, you're actually turning in parts of public land into flood zones, essentially. And so, and there's no real way around it. Animals, unfortunately, people can climb over, but animals cannot climb over these walls. And then the different types of walls that exist, you get wash or debris stuck inside of the wall itself. And even when there was a place for water to move through, there's not. And so it just moves around and finds something else, whether it pushes the wall down or does some other things. So it's caused significant damages in towns and communities, and then also on our public lands. And the laws range anything from the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, Clean Air, Clean Water, Migratory Birds, and then there's some civil liberty laws like the Administrative Procedures Act, which deals with a whole host of issues around, you know, your rights on American soil, and then also wilderness areas, all of that stuff basically gone, and the ability for CBP officers to conduct their surveillance and or operations on lands with no respect to any of that. And some of the problems are too, is that because they've waived the laws, they don't do any impact statements. They're not talking to the community. And so they're building infrastructure in places where they've actually never studied the land. And there's been some significant environmental impacts to areas because they actually don't know what's underneath the ground or if the ground can hold the weight of the type of wall they want to build. And so it's really expensive in terms of the building piece, but then even more expensive in terms of the cleanup.
So just to summarize, the law in question, to dive into the alphabet soup, would be NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and that's what gets waived by these congressional bills that let them ignore NEPA if they're doing stuff along the border. Is that the short version here?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about one of my favorite stories along the border in terms of wildlife coming back. And this is the jaguar that's been wandering up into southern Arizona. Brian or Katie, since you've both been following this, how long has this been in the works that folks have been hoping that jaguars would move back into the U.S. from Mexico?
Well, this is Katie. I think, you know, since we extirpated them back, you know, 100 years ago, that people have been working to try to ensure that, A, that the jaguars are protected in Mexico and sustained in Mexico, but also that eventually they make it back up into the U.S. I mean, this has been decades, at least, you know, in terms of endangered species listing and sort of more public awareness, probably, you know, in the last couple of decades. But I think this is even a long-term goal for many people on, and again, on both sides of the border. And that's something that Brian alluded to, is these binational cooperation agreements, the work that's the work that's being done. We have local partners in the region, like Northern Jaguar Project in Mexico and Skyland Alliance in the U.S., who have been actively trying to promote conservation of wildlife corridors so that these jaguars can move into the U.S. for decades now. It's ongoing.
And how many do we have now? At least one, or are there more than that confirmed now at this point?
And Brian, you might even have more updated information than I do, but we know that there were two recently. One was named, and these were named by school children, El Jefe, and then a more recent one called Sombra. And I think, you know, it's still, I don't know if both of those are still in the U.S. as far as we know, but tracking these animals is very difficult, obviously.
Yeah, in the last decade, there's been about seven. And what's really fascinating is because the border in Arizona is largely federal land or tribal land, actually, the Tohono O'odham Nation is there and has a huge section of the international border. But the few places that have not had wall constructed yet are these little, tiny, very rugged gaps down around Nogales, Arizona. And that's where these jaguars, we think, are crossing. And the report by Wildlands Network, they just released, as well as a lot of work by other scientists and defenders of wildlife, we found that these tiny corridors are where the jaguar has been crossing into the United States. And if those are sealed off, then natural recovery of the jaguar in the United States of America is virtually confirmed to not happen. It will not happen, and we'll have to spend extremely large amounts of money to look at the viability of translocating those animals from their Mexican population back to the United States of America, which we don't even know if that's viable, let alone how much it would cost. So, you know, if they seal off the Arizona border, that's probably it for the jaguar in the United States.
So, Kieran, where are we in terms of the Trump administration and their plans and or hopes and dreams? Have they expressed any interest in even working with conservation groups on either side of the border to ensure that wildlife and endangered species can thrive? Or is this not even on their radar?
Yeah, I would say the political rhetoric is not even pointed near endangered species and where they are. And unfortunately, it's become very polarized and toxic rhetoric that's come out of the administration in terms of why they would like to build a wall in general, and focusing on problems that frankly, you know, don't exist, especially because there are reports from both the FBI and also internally within the federal government that show that border crossings are down and things like that. So you would think that with that information and understanding that this would impact America's amazing wildlife, that they would kind of redirect. But right now, what we're looking at congressionally are a couple of things. There's still a proposal to fund at least $1.6 billion to build the wall itself in both the House and the Senate. And so the House version of that passed. The Senate will be looking at that between now and the end of the year. And there's also proposals to build other technological infrastructures that could have some environmental impacts as well. But we won't know what those are because they, again, are asking the waive laws to build those pieces. So no, it's not looking like the administration wants to change its tune and that they would really like to be able to cash in on their campaign promise of building wall in the remaining places where it doesn't already exist.
The alternative investments are pretty impressive. I mean, we could be investing in international trade, and there's already a flourishing economy along the border. And if you go down into Texas around McAllen, you see this flourishing economy that's based on ecotourism, it's based on trade, it's based on those types of things. There are other alternatives for investment. And just to give you a small example, you know, for about the cost of building 10 miles of wall under the current estimates, we could entirely recover the Mexican gray wolf population, entire population, for less than 1 mile, we could entirely recover the Sonoran pronghorn population. And for about the cost of 2.2 miles, we could recover the jaguar. So, you know, I think there are extremely mixed up priorities in this administration.
Are there specific politicians that any of you are watching when it comes to Congress or the administration, when it comes to the potential of building a border wall? Are there champions in Congress or potential swing votes in Congress who could have a significant impact on whether or not this happens?
Karen, you want to answer that? Or?
Sure. I wasn't sure if someone else wanted to take that. I can say this. I can say that there are Democrats, all of the Democrats have been very vocal about being against the wall. There are a few Republicans who are against the wall too. So I'm very interested to seeing, you know, as some of these votes get ready to come down, where Senator McCain or Senator Flake come out on this piece at the end. Neither one of them have anything to lose. McCain just won his reelection and Mr. Flake has decided to retire. So, there are those pieces. And there's some other ones that haven't been vocal either way. So there's a little bit of hope there that folks will decide that maybe this is not a good use of government time, money, or energy. And then we should focus on, as Brian described, like other things like putting money towards the gray wolf, the Mexican wolf, recovery.
Yeah, and I'll just also point out that I think there's fairly universal Democratic opposition in the House and the Senate, but also that there's been quite an interesting turn of events that most local governments along the entire length of the borders are passing resolutions against border wall construction and additional militarization of the border, because this goes beyond just building a wall. We're getting into things like lighting and drones and vehicles, and it's a full-on militarization of the border. I think you're seeing this trend of local governments that are turning against it. So hopefully that will have some influence on our federal government's decisions, in particular Congress.
Let's get Katie back in here. Folks have mentioned the Mexican wolf a couple of times. What's the status of that species and bringing it back into the U.S.? And is that the kind of situation where you'd see the same sort of pushback from ranchers that we've seen in the Northwest with wolf populations? Or is it less controversial along the southern side?
No, I would say it's definitely just as controversial. There are populations of Mexican wolf in both the U.S. and in Mexico, and that we know that individuals, at least from Mexico, have been caught moving up into the U.S. Usually those individuals are captured and then placed back either in a captive population or in an area where the reintroduced or recovering populations are located. It's very controversial. There's individuals that are working on dealing with that, the social aspect of recovery of an animal like the wolf. Defenders has a program that works on reducing that human conflict. And I would say too, that's something that when we look at something like the border wall, or any sort of fragmentation of habitat, we generally, you know, we're advocating for recovery and we're advocating for protecting those areas. And part of that advocating for that and understanding why these animals need wide open protected landscapes is that when you have the ability to disperse and move through protected landscapes, have habitat that is suitable and thriving for these animals, you can hopefully also reduce some of that human conflict because you won't be pushing animals into situations where they'd need to rely on non-native food sources or search for water sources or something like that outside of their natural habitat. And so I think that protecting these cross-border pathways and habitat on both sides of the border does help reduce that human-animal conflict and hopefully helps spur recovery. But it's obviously a challenge. And again, what you know, Brian mentioned, that cost, the money that could be directed elsewhere, funding to educate the population on wolves and the benefit of wolves, to work on this, reducing that type of conflict, that's money we should be spending. And that's money that you know, the groups and the federal government in both Mexico and the U.S., you know, people are working on that. And if we could focus on those hurdles, I think we'd go a long way to helping recovery of Mexican wolves. And that would obviously be a much better use of our funds.
All right. Very quickly to each of you with the time we have left, what is the number one thing that someone who is listening to this podcast right now and wants to do something about these threats and about the potential of the border wall, what's the number one thing they can do? Brian?
Well, get involved in all of these local coalitions that are working against the border wall. There's a couple of different good websites you can go to. The Sierra Club has a toolbox up on their website. You just look up on Sierra Club Border Wall Toolbox, and it gives you really everything you need to get engaged.
Kieran, I suspect Brian might have stolen your answer there.
Sorry.
I have anything more, else? Though. You need to call your member of Congress, and you need to definitely ask your friends and family who live outside of the border region to call their members of Congress, because the more folks outside of the border region say, hey, I don't want my tax dollars going down to building a wall along the border, the more likely it is that we were able to really focus on this.
Katie.
Sure. Yeah. So I want to again reiterate, yes, contact your representatives everywhere, wherever you live. Everyone has a voice in Congress, and we need to make sure that's being heard. I think also in terms of spreading information and awareness, it would be great if people who are interested in this, you know, they look at the documents and the resources and the photos that all of our groups are providing and start to share those on social media so that we can also start to change the narrative of the Borderlands region so that we can talk about the collaboration, the cultural diversity, the economic drivers, the richness of this area and the possibility to exist. So we can change the perception, the public perception, which I think would go a long way to changing some of the politics around this issue.
All right. Katie Davis with Wildlands Network, Brian Bird, Defenders of Wildlife, Kieran Kennedy with the Sierra Club. Thanks so much to all three of you for joining the podcast and sharing all of the information you have. All three of you, a huge resource, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time today.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was this week, 114 years ago, when an explosion killed two mining company managers in the town of Cripple Creek, Colorado. It raised tensions in the midst of a statewide labor uprising. That blast happened 600 feet down in the Vindicator Mine. The mining company blamed the union, the Western Federation of Miners, and 15 strike leaders were arrested, but never prosecuted. The coroner's jury couldn't determine what caused the blast. The union claimed it was all a plot by the mine owners who were trying to keep the militia from being sent home. See, the miners had gone on strike at Cripple Creek back in August, and the governor had sent in the National Guard to union bust, providing protection to replacement workers, harassing union supporters, even arresting children who mocked the soldiers. Then came the Vindicator mine explosion at the end of November. By the first week of December, the governor had declared martial law, putting General Sherman Bell, a former mine manager, in charge of the town of Cripple Creek. The National Guard suspended the Bill of Rights, they started censoring any pro-union information from the local paper, they confiscated all weapons and ammunition, there was no freedom to assemble, and union members who won habeas corpus cases in court were released from the courthouse and then immediately rearrested. In the coming months, the National Guard carried out large-scale deportations of Union members. The district attorney was the former secretary of the Mine Owners Association. He even refused to prosecute any court cases against the mining companies or a local vigilante group known as the Citizens Alliance. The whole situation came to a head the following June when an explosion killed 13 people at the train station in Independence, Colorado. The Citizens Alliance basically took over the town. They forced the sheriff to resign at gunpoint. The National Guard surrounded the Union Hall, leading to an hour-long gunfight. The Citizens Alliance, which was remarkably prepared for this bombing, theoretically against their sympathizers, rounded up 175 Union members and sympathizers. They set up a kangaroo court the next day and immediately deported 38 Union members. General Sherman then showed up and tried more than 1,500 prisoners, finding more than 230 of them guilty, which is to say, they didn't renounce the Union. And that was, essentially, the end of the Western Federation of Miners in Cripple Creek. As for that explosion at the train station, a Union member named Harry Orchard confessed to setting dynamite under the train platform, but years later, Orchard also confessed to being a paid spy for the mine owners, working for the notorious Pinkerton Detective Agency. Historians now say that there's lots of evidence that the train station bombing was in fact a setup by the mine owners, designed to end the Union once and for all, and they succeeded. That original confession, by the way, came when Orchard was being threatened with immediate hanging for killing the governor of Idaho, Frank Steunenberg. And Orchard's only way out was to implicate Union officials in court. And so he did, blaming the Union for both the train station bombing and the Vindicator mine bombing that happened this week in 1903. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. We always love to hear from you. Please keep the feedback and the story ideas coming to podcast@westernpriorities.org. And if you're talking about podcasts at your Thanksgiving dinner, why not recommend us to your aunts and uncles? Word of mouth is the best way for folks to find us, along with those ever so important reviews on iTunes. Thanks again to our guests this week, Katie Davis, Brian Bird, and Kieran Kennedy. We've got links to all of their work on the border wall in the show notes. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, have a very happy Thanksgiving.